The sun is finally shining after what feels like months of rain. And as I walk through the wrought iron gate into Philoli's walled garden, I hear the sound of a burbling fountain. And I see bright blue sky that gives way to clouds of cascading cherry blossoms. Sometimes, when I'm walking in a garden like this all alone in the morning, I'm reminded that this was once a very personal space. Designed not for the public, but for a few specific people, to suit their tastes and what made them happy. This morning, I feel almost like I'm walking in the footsteps of Agnes Born, who, along with her husband William, created this garden for their own enjoyment. Agnes was in her 50s when Philoli was built, so she knew what she liked, and she spent years dreaming up this garden. There's nowhere I sense her presence as strongly as at the sundial, which is where I'm stopping right now. It anchors the walled garden at the intersection of two paths, and today is surrounded by pots of white and red tulips. An inscription on its dial reads, "Time began in a garden." We have a photo of Agnes, standing proudly next to the sundial, resting her elbow on top and squinting into the sun. Around her, her garden grows lush and tall, and I wonder what it would have looked like in color, instead of the black and white that's all we're left with 100 years later. From Philoli Historic House and Garden in Woodside, California, I'm your host, Interpretation Manager Willa Brock, and this is another Morning in the Garden. Come with me to frolic among the peonies and wisteria as we explore the human stories behind these blooms. Let's talk about the ways people have shaped this garden over the years, and what might turn someone, maybe you, into a plant person. To kick off today, I get to go talk with someone who knows a lot about the stories of Philoli's garden and its plants. John Chow, Philoli's plant curator. In classic April fashion, it's actually still a little chilly in the air, but the sun is shining and I'm walking up towards the south end of the garden to meet John at the tree peony bed.
Hello!
How's it going?
Good, good.
Huh, okay. So plant curator is, I feel like, pretty cool sounding, but people might not know exactly what it is that you do.
Here at Philoli, we have two big collections, the museum collections mm-hmm. and the living collection.
It's funny because you have your counterpart, Kevin, as the curator of the house, and you guys each have a collection you're working with. It just looks a little different.
Yes, exactly.
What does your day-to-day look like?
I spend a lot of time out in the garden, checking on what is happening with the plants there.
Because you have to see them to be up to date. Right.
And then once I'm done taking those sorts of notes in the field, I can go back to the computer and update our database.
Right. And the rest of the horticulture team relies on those records to make decisions and ordering new things, planting, stuff like that.
Yes. I work very closely with everyone else in horticulture to help with planning for the garden.
Mm-hmm. So will you just give maybe a little introduction to this part of the garden and our collection?
So there are many species of peonies all around the world. There are native ones, actually, in California.
There are native California peonies.
They're not so showy, but they're very cute. So all of our, like, the more commonly cultivated peonies are from Asia. Mm-hmm. There are herbaceous ones, which are probably the most common ones. Every year, they have new growth from their underground roots.
Oh.
They don't leave any woody stems above ground over the winter. But then there are tree peonies or woody peonies that have woody stems that persist year after year.
So it's not that they look like trees, because they're not very tall.
Yeah, it's not that they look like trees. It's that they're woody.
The other thing that always strikes me about these tree peonies is how gigantic the blooms are.
Yeah, yeah. So peonies are known for their really large, almost dinner plate size blooms. A lot of them are double, meaning they have more petals, so they're very full, like a pom-pom.
You're totally like a pom-pom. I see it. And we're looking right now at the bed. There are a ton of different plants.
Over 100 plants in this bed. Mm-hmm. And about 40 named cultivars.
Okay. Here at the tree peony bed is the location for a really interesting human story that we have in Philoli's history, which is the relationship between the Demoto family and their nursery in the East Bay with both families that lived at Filoli over the years. So I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about the Demotos and how we see their legacy still here in the garden today.
Yeah, so one of the special things about our tree peony collection is that we have hybrid peonies that were created by Toichi Demoto, who did a lot of plant breeding. Mm-hmm. He was a Japanese-American nursery owner. His parents immigrated from Japan, and his father and uncle were the first in his family to start a nursery in the United States. And the Demoto family and their nursery was very important in importing a lot of new plants to American horticulture.
Like what?
Like camellias, azaleas, Japanese maples, a lot of plants that were big in Japanese horticulture, but had not yet become popular here in the U.S.
So this is time scale, we're talking early 1900s?
Early 1900s.
Yeah, 1900s. And you just wouldn't have seen those plants in California gardens yet.
Right. Yep. And yes, and they were some of the first people to import those plants to the U.S. and popularize them. So as far as we know, both the Bournes and the Roths purchased plants from the Demoto nursery. They were a huge nursery. So likely some of our old wisteria are from the Demoto nursery.
The 100-year wisteria on the house? Wow. Right. Okay.
And then during the Roth era, Lurline Roth really loved camellias, which the Demoto nursery had a lot of. Also, the Japanese maples in the woodland garden. A lot of our azaleas, like the Ward's Ruby.
The bright, bright red azalea that you'll see actually blooming right now in the walled garden.
Yeah, and tree peonies.
Tree peonies.
As Toichi Demoto was getting older, I don't think anyone in his family was going to take over the nursery. So around 1990, he wanted to donate his tree peonies to a garden in the Bay Area where people could appreciate them, and he decided on donating them here to Filoli.
Oh, God. And so tell me about the hybrids that we call the Demoto hybrids here in this area.
To get a new plant variety, to hybridize a plant, what you would do is find two parent plants, a dad and a mom.
With qualities that you like.
With qualities that you like. Flower color, size, the vigor of the plant.
It's like having a baby and being like, I hope he gets the dad's green eyes and the mom's cute nose or something.
Exactly. So you would take the pollen from the dad and put it onto the future seed pod of the mom. You know, the genetics of the two parents would combine to form the seed inside. Then you would plant those seeds, probably have to wait at least 10 years for that new plant to grow up and flower.
Okay. Wow.
And you would probably be planting hundreds, if not thousands, of these seeds to get them all to grow up so you could choose which is the best one.
So this is like a long-term science experiment.
Yes. Requires a lot of time and land to plant all those seeds because, you know, out of hundreds, there might be a dozen that you actually like and want to propagate.
So this is why Toichi had like a unique opportunity to do this, because he had the land, he had the nursery, and he had the knowledge as a floriculturalist of what might be two parent plants that would make something new and amazing.
Right, exactly. Okay. Yep.
Do we have any that are blooming right now?
Let's go look at one. It's at this.
I also love the names of all the tree peonies.
Yeah, so this one, you'll notice like a lot of ours have names related to Greek mythology.
Yes, I did notice that.
So like, that was from a Greek American artist and plant breeder.
That's the way you really tie your own story to a plant, is by naming it something that means something to you. My other favorite, which I think the kids always appreciate, is the Black Panther tree peony.
So at the very south end of the tree peony bed, we have a couple different named varieties that Toichi Demoto made. Some are just about to flower, like this Princess Chiffon.
Princess Chiffon. What was he thinking when he named it that, I wonder? I guess chiffon has a very specific feel to it. Maybe it's about the feel of the petals.
It has these big, full pink flowers.
Mm. Right now, it's still in bud form, and you can see, like, the green is slowly receding, and the pink is coming out.
There's also this one, Royal Robe.
Royal Robe.
A slightly deeper shade of pink, like a pink purple.
If you had to guess, or maybe you know, what was he looking for when he created these hybrids? What do you think he was solving for with his combo?
Color, uh-huh. Large flowers. And we can see here how these plants, their flowers are very upright. Like mm-hmm. they have strong stems and their flowers are going to face up. So a lot of tree peonies, their flowers are so big and heavy, they actually droop.
Yes.
And then you can't really see the flower.
I've totally had that experience because I wanted to take pictures of it. But I've been like, well, I have to fully lie underneath this plant and get a picture.
So I think these strong stems with top-facing flowers are another quality that you might have been looking for. And you know, a lot of peonies are also fragrant.
Oh, I did not know that.
So when you come see them, mm-hmm. give them a whiff.
Okay.
If they're close to the path.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite that has a fragrance?
There's some that are peach colored mm-hmm. that have a really nice fragrance.
Okay. My last question is just if there's plants that you feel especially connected to in this garden because of a story for them or because they just touch you in some way.
One plant that I really like and I connect with are the lilacs here by the U Alley. Mm. So, you know, lilacs aren't that common in California. Yeah. Again, like the tree peonies, they like a colder climate. But they grow well here at Filoli because it is a little colder here in this mountain valley where we're located. Mm-hmm. And they're beautifully scented plants.
Yeah.
And I remember the first time I had really seen a lilac was when I was in school in Los Angeles, where I grew up. And my English teacher, he lived in the mountains above Los Angeles, and he brought us like some sprigs of lilac during one class.
How old were you?
It was probably like in ninth grade or so.
Yeah, yeah.
But he brought them because we were reading this poem by Walt Whitman called When Last the Lilac Bloomed, about the death of Abraham Lincoln.
What a good teacher. I wonder if you could go back and tell John that's holding a lilac, ninth grade John, like, you're going to be a plant curator.
Yeah, I think he would have been very happy.
John heads back to his plant records, and I head through the walled garden towards the garden terraces at the back of the house. I'm meeting Haley O'Connor and Andrew Bellowin to look at one of the 100-year-old wisteria vines that climbs up the backside of the house. Hey guys, how's it going?
Good, good.
Hey, Haley.
Good morning, Willa. Welcome to our wisteria hysteria morning.
We are in hysterics over the wisteria. And this is the time to be talking because it's all starting, isn't it?
Yeah, for us, the bloom starts in the courtyard where it's nice and warm with some of the sinensis going first.
Because of all the brick?
Because of all the brick, it's totally an enclosed space.
Yeah.
So it heats up and then it's sort of wraps north around the house. Looking at the largest wisteria and probably the oldest wisteria.
You think?
Yeah,
wow.
I do. I mean, look at that trunk.
It's older and larger than the one on the front of the house over the front door?
Yeah. I mean, I think that we have a lot of wisteria that was planted at the same time.
Sure.
This is one of the original wisteria.
And you can tell because you look at the vine itself and it's humongous.
It looks like a tree trunk.
Yeah.
You know, a hollow tree trunk at this point.
It actually lost about half of itself about a year and
a
half ago.
What happened?
It broke at the base here, and it used to go up this way to this balcony. And I think it was about a year and a half ago that it fell.
And gardeners lovingly nicknamed this wisteria King Kong because of its size. It's a silky wisteria, which, you know, is one of, there are about, there's a handful of wisteria out there. We have four of the species, or we have three of the species. We have the Chinese, we have the Japanese, and then we have the silky.
Okay.
So sinensis, floribunda, and silky.
Wow. And it's called silky because of the leaves or the petals?
I mean, one way you can see silky, we're going to walk over to the plant. The buds are kind of, when they swell, they're sort of squat, and then the leaves have a little bit of a silky texture.
Okay, I see it. We're looking at this
a furry, sorry, like a furry texture.
A furry texture. It's this one is just starting to bud out. So there's a couple blooms that have their petals out, but a lot of them are still in the bud form here. And Andrew, are you one of the people who cares for King Kong?
Yeah, I am. I've been caring for it for about 3 years now. I think it was the first thing I ever worked on here, too. Yeah.
What was the learning curve like?
Oh, it was pretty steep. I remember Luis, who used to work here, did the bottom half, and then we had to do the top half.
And you were pruning it?
Yeah.
She sent the newbies on the ladder and the balconies.
Because of that, I really like it.
It's So wait, how tall of a ladder do you have to be on to get up there?
Well, it's a 15-foot ladder, but we can't reach it all the way from there. We have to go up on the balcony and prune from the top and use extension pruners.
You know, it is actually, you always know it's that time of year when, if you're one of the office workers who works in the house, all of a sudden you start hearing noises outside the window and you see the horticulturalist kind of like daringly dangling from the balcony, pruning the wisteria. Yeah. So when does this happen normally, the pruning?
I think it starts in like December, usually it goes until January, February.
Okay. Yeah. And you're making sure to kind of be curating what it's going to look like come spring.
Yeah, so we're pruning for the way that the flowers fall. And you can do that a number of ways, but you can two-bud it or you can three or four-bud it. We mostly two-bud here.
What do you mean by two or three-bud?
So when you're pruning and you see the little offshoots off of these little clouds, we call them, you can count the number of buds that lead off the stem.
Okay.
And then we'll prune it to the second bud.
Okay.
And so you'll get two flowers, two or three flowers, depending on how many buds or nodes you leave. They're going to develop into these beautiful clusters of flowers. If we were not to prune this, it would have more flowers, but it would have less vigor to grow. And there we have pretty vigorous, but also ancient wisteria.
Right.
I mean, we're looking at a 100-year-old trunk. So we really want to keep things as tight as possible, so there's not too much weight on these long limbs.
Ooh, it's about the weight, because if you had more blooms,
it'd be heavy. It would use a lot of energy. It would need more water. It would also overwhelm any supports that we have set up for the wisteria.
So what have you learned after caring for this vine over the last 3 years? What surprised you?
Kong usually takes a solid week to prune with like three horticulturalists. Yeah. And so you get to have a pretty good relationship with it by the end. And that's one of the best things about pruning wisteria, I think. I love pruning wisteria. It might be my favorite thing to do in Philolea. Yeah.
And then are you keeping an eye on it as spring comes to kind of come and see the fruits of your labor?
Oh, yeah. And we definitely take note of like the way we pruned it and see if we can improve it next year. Yeah.
And then in the summer, we're coming back and giving it a second sort of summer prune, which is less structural and more just to control that vigor.
Yeah.
So we're taking all the whips off in June and July.
What do you guys like about wisteria? Like, what's your favorite thing about it?
Personally, I might not be a popular opinion, but I like the way it looks in the winter when it's all bare. I think it looks like a beautiful giant bonsai, if that makes sense.
I see that.
Yeah.
I am like a romantic. I love its scent. I also really love the pods. It's in the pea family, so it makes a pea pod. That's its fruit. And I love gathering those. They're sort of furry and fun to fun to have as a little bundle.
What do you do with them?
Well, you know, I use them in like arrangements and I'll just fill a little bowl with them and I'll you know, hand them out. The one funny thing is guests will come and they want to collect the seed. And if you plant a wisteria by seed, it could take 20 years to ever bloom. So this is one thing I'll tell people when they're buying wisteria. Make sure it's full of flowers and that you like the flowers. I don't recommend buying wisteria when it's not in flower, or make sure it has seed pods. But it's best to just propagate wisteria by cutting and buy wisteria that's propagated by cutting.
Sure.
So you know what you have.
And so working with wisteria seems like it requires a lot of patience and a lot of delayed gratification. Would you say that's true? Or just balance, maybe?
Yeah, balance, definitely. Patience, yeah. I don't know. I like the way all the stages of the wisteria, so I don't.
Your gratification is not delayed.
Yeah.
I would say as long as you're staying on top of it, it's not a plant I would plant and walk away from. It doesn't go out of bounds. And once it's established, it actually doesn't really need a lot of water. And if you give it too much water, it'll rot. So it's a great San Francisco Bay Area plant. But it's one of those plants that has become invasive because it isn't really cared for. So you have to be responsible with wisterias.
Right, because it's pretty aggressive.
Yeah, it's aggressive and it needs pruning. If we turn around on the balustrade, we have wisteria that are probably 40 years old and they have been kept in a shrub form. You know, those would cover the entire field behind them, probably an acre if we never touched them.
Wow.
So it's just about managing, you know, managing your vine.
Right. So what is it like working on something that's so old and that has this kind of history? Do you feel the touch of the past gardeners?
Oh, yeah. You can see all their decisions that they've made. Yeah. And you have a certain responsibility to keep it going.
You're carrying on the legacy.
Yeah.
Do you have conversations with them? Like when I'm pruning at Filoli, I have conversations with all of the cuts that I'm in contact with.
What do you say?
Just like, oh, I see that decision. You know, you disagree with it or you're like, oh, my gosh, this is so beautiful. You don't want to touch it. You come across everything.
Yeah.
I mean, you're dealing with 100 years of decision making.
Right.
I do talk to it too all the time. Yeah. Because a lot of the smaller ones you're working on by yourself and it's winter and no one's around.
Yeah.
So you're kind of just talking to yourself and the plant.
So you're talking to the plant or the people who have cared for it in the past.
Yeah. Both. Yeah. And a lot of the wisteria are really beautiful, like the one in the corner.
Yeah.
By the Sunken Garden. That's one of my favorites. It has such a nice structure.
Should we walk over there?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
It's so gorgeous.
I really love that one.
Is it because of the way it lies along the balustrade and then kind of...
Yeah, and I think that it's a good height to prune and you're not on a ladder.
It's so pleasant to care for.
And really take their time and like really make good decisions. And they have, and it looks great.
What's this one that we're walking towards called?
This is Frankie.
Frankie.
Named after my dog.
Why did you name it after your dog?
Because it's my favorite wisteria.
Okay. And he's your favorite dog.
Frankie is white. And we do have white wisteria that I would say look more like the luck dragon, a never ending story, which is what Frankie looks like.
But this is a purple wisteria.
It has a purple soul.
Frankie has a purple soul. What are some other wisteria that have names?
Jim calls one of them that grape soda. What is grape soda called?
No.
It's not Fanta, but it's like in that world of grape soda. Because they can smell really...
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes, like, that's how people describe wisteria is like...
Fun smell.
Yeah, grape soda.
And does it make it easier for you guys, like, operationally to have names for the different plants? Because you can be like, oh, I'm heading over to Frankie today.
Yeah, it makes it fun. I think we like doing it. I think Taylor did name the white one in the courtyard, Gertrude.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why?
Gertrude Stein, I think.
Nice.
Yeah.
That totally makes sense to me.
Yeah.
It's 9:56.
Okay. Do you guys have to go?
In 1 minute. I wanted to say that John taught me yesterday how to remember. So sinensis and floribunda.
Yeah.
Floribunda wraps clockwise.
Yeah.
So the Japanese wisteria always will vine clockwise. And the Chinese wisteria will vine counterclockwise. Oh. Something that I haven't observed, but in time lapse you can see. And sinensis comes from the Latin root, same root
left.
For left. Yeah.
Sinister.
And sinister, you know, left. And so I think that is just a really wonderful, cool fact.
Really, really cool.
Yes. One thing I'll say just from the couple of years that I've watched the plants at Filoli, you get really attached to certain moments and certain activities. And it's amazing to be at a garden like Filoli, where you're interacting with that history and like creating your own history and documenting it. It's fun to go back into our photos, you know, into the 1920s and see some of these wisteria in full bloom as these tiny little plants.
And now maybe someone 50 years from now will be talking to you and your cuts when they're caring for the wisteria. It's time to close our show with some questions from listeners. I crisscrossed Filoli to find the right person to answer each one. For this first question, I head up towards the cutting garden and spot Rachel doing some planting. Hey, Rachel. Do you have a sec?
Yeah.
I have a garden guide question for you. Ro asked us, how do you get rid of oxalis safely? I have cats.
So oxalis is a really common weed. It looks like a clover.
Okay.
And it has yellow flowers that come up in a stalk. And
I've seen this.
Yeah. A common name for it is sourgrass because those flowers are edible.
I remember eating those as a kid.
They're sour. They're like candy. But oxalis, it contains oxalic acid. So you don't want to eat too many. You don't want to let the kids eat too many because it'll give you a stomach ache. So some people like the oxalis. Yeah. They've made peace with it. It's pretty, you know, it's a clover. People like that. But it can take over a garden. Yeah. I think the question asker is maybe saying, please no herbicide because I have cats is my guess. What I would recommend for a organic approach would be sheet mulching.
Okay.
So first you'd go through and hand pull as best as you can on the roots. If you get the whole roots, you'll find little nodules on them.
Okay.
And those turn into seeds. So if you're pulling oxalis and you get the root and you see little bulbs on them, you could feel really good about yourself because you really got it. And then you'd put down a layer of cardboard and cover that with 2-3 inches of mulch. Okay. And that can help suppress the weeds. And if you catch it kind of late winter, early spring, just when it's starting to come up, it hasn't flowered yet, it hasn't made a carpet, you'll miss most of your oxalis if you cover it with enough wood chips.
And that's just because the weeds physically can't get through the cardboard.
That's right. Yeah. We're cutting off the sun. Yeah. Some of them might come through, but a lot fewer.
Yeah. And
it's also just helping the health of your soil.
Right.
I think it looks really nice and neat. Big fan of mulch.
Okay. That was so helpful. Thank you so much, Rachel. Good luck with your planting. All right. So for my second garden guide question, I have just found Kirk Crippens, one of the horticulturalists here in the Walled Garden. He's standing a little bit like Austin Powers here next to the tulip beds, holding Beans the cat in his arms. Hi.
Hi.
I'm going to ask you and your coworker one of our questions. This one was submitted by Tori, and they ask, I never know how to find the right plants to co-plant. What's important to look for in deciding what can be harmonious in a garden?
Okay. Well, it's interesting that we're standing here right now because we planted in these beds in the wall garden, we planted tulips, a purple ombre mix of tulips bulbs. And then we also underneath planted a common name, baby blue eyes. We call it Nemophila, the botanical name. And it's a California native. And our vision for it was a bed of a baby blue eye flowers underneath the beautiful tulips that would raise up through the Nemophila.
Right, the high and the low.
Exactly. And so it didn't work out in part because as soon as we planted the Nemophila, we think is what happened. Birds came and ate it like a salad. Now, in the future, we're probably going to consider something else that may be hardier or maybe the birds wouldn't eat. Another thing to consider is timing. We have in the Dutch garden beautiful hellebores, which flower in the winter.
Yes.
And so and when a lot of things were dormant in the garden, the hellebores were blooming. And we planted daffodils. And so when these winter blooming hellebores came out, these beautiful yellow daffodils came springing up out of the garden. And the contrast in color and in vibrancy was just a wonderful mix. And so that in that case, it worked out really well.
I remember seeing that and thinking it was so unexpected almost because you'd never think that they would kind of play well together. But it really grew on me. And then I know you guys are also thinking about attracting pollinators when you're thinking of planting, you know, companion plants. Is that something that's on your mind as well?
It is for sure. We're trying to plant things for the bees.
Yes.
And so one big consideration is how can we have things flowering all the time? One interesting thing that came up this year is this plant called an arc angelica,
yes,
which is tall. I'm 6'1". It's taller than me. It's like 9 feet tall. It sprung up like a sculpture in the garden and put out its flowers and attracted the bees and everybody's questions. Like, what is that?
Wow. Okay. So when you're co-planting, you're like playing 3D chess. You're thinking about timing. You're thinking about color. And you're thinking about attracting those bees to keep those blooms coming.
That's absolutely correct.
Very cool. Well, I will leave you here with Beans, who is kind of relaxing on your forearm, surveying his kingdom.
Yes.
Thank you so much for being our garden guide today. Do you have a question for our garden guides? DM us on Instagram, email learning@philoly.org, or check out the podcast page on our website. We would love to hear from you.
thank you for spending this morning in the garden with me at Philoli. Don't forget to leave a review or share with a friend if you enjoyed. In 2 weeks, begin your day by looking up with me at the century-old trees that arch over the garden's blooms. We'll be exploring the ins and outs of caring for a historic garden and the inevitable goodbyes and hellos as years pass, trees fall, and new plant stories begin. Until then, wander under the wisteria and feel your footsteps echoing those who came before and left their mark on this place.